And he can't. Because God wants to. And he wants to turn back and start again. And he can't. Because he's reached the aviator's point of no return, which is that point when it takes more gas to go back to the beginning than it does to go on to the goal, even when you've lost interest in the goal. And so you just complete the journey in which you no longer have an interest. And you have your whole contemporary literature, a literature of escapism, once you have been sucked into this mood of inevitability. I have the feeling that the hardest task of the educator today is to meet this climate. Some of my friends tell me that in our own little university we've got a terrific problem in building the right kind of curriculum. They ask where we stand. Do we follow Hutchins or do we go with Dewey? Is it a school like Sarah Lawrence or is it going to be a school like its opposite? And I have to smile at questions of that kind, because what difference does it make? We're only talking about techniques. The basic task of the educator, the task that we must all share, whether we're teachers or ministers or people in the field of social service or editors or any who mold public opinion, the basic task is to give anchorage to young people so that they believe in themselves and in their capacity to conquer the problems that they have to face. What else matters except that? They must not suffer from what Gilbert Murray so brilliantly described as the failure of nerve when he was talking about the Hellenistic society which succumbed under the onslaught of the Romans. In that chapter in his Five Stages of Greek Religion, he pointed out that the Hellenistic group didn't succumb because of the superior organization of the Romans or a superior civilization. They succumbed because they lost faith in themselves. They no longer believed that they had the capacity to cope with problems which were too much for them. And so they suffered from a failure of nerve. And we must meet that. We must meet that dreadful danger. It's more important than any of the dangers that face us. And you can build all the armaments you like. And you can ask for credentials right down to the last civil servant. And you can scrutinize his record way back to the days of the 20s. And it's not going to help you if your society has been paralyzed by the belief, by the conviction, that there's an inevitability about all that's to come. That must be faced, and that must be met. I read a rather remarkable book recently by a soldier called Dwight Eisenhower. He called it Crusade in Europe. About a third of it I didn't even understand. I'm not a military man. I don't know too much about tactics or strategy. And he spent a good deal of his time analyzing the technical aspects of the war in Europe. But what did make an impact upon me was the fact that this man, who is a good symbol of the best in the buoyant American spirit, met the problem of the dogma of inevitability with the conviction of solvability. He believed that if problems had been created, they had to be faced and they could be met. He wasn't at all cocky or dogmatic. He didn't know whether he had the answers. He wasn't sure that he could solve the problems right. But he was sure that the quickest way that you can fail is to face those problems in the mood of impending failure. He had to build the greatest coalition in history, and coalitions are notoriously difficult to handle. He had to bring together people like Joe Stalin and de Gaulle and Darlan and a prima donna like FDR, for whom Eisenhower has a great deal of affection. But every page of the book indicates what a difficult person he was. And an even greater prima donna like Winston Churchill and Queen Wilhelmina. There was a gal. People of that kind. And he wasn't playing for buttons. He was playing for lives, millions of them, and billions in treasure. And he might have said, this is a temporary instrument that we're building. And as we move forward in the solution of our great problems upon which depend so many destinies, we had better always watch ourselves for the next step. He didn't do that at all. He worked on the assumption that this was a workable problem that he had. And if there was enough confidence in its solution, it would be solved. He might not be the one to solve it, but it would be solved if there were enough stamina and enough courage and enough faith in solvability. And of course, it's in that spirit that so many of the great American heroes have functioned. We have a number of hazards to overcome if we're to build an affirmative climate. And one certainly doesn't have to be a Pollyanna to talk about that. I'd never have any influence over young people if I said to them that these problems didn't exist, if we poo-pooed them and we told them that they were battling with ghosts. The problems are there. And you don't meet them as a Pollyanna would with roseate glasses. But the creation of an affirmative climate is possible. It's possible, I should say, first of all, by making it perfectly clear that the presence of problems is no sign of decadence, that the multiplicity of problems is no sign that our society is pathological. Simply because you open up your morning newspaper and you find 50 problems where you had only two or three a generation ago as a nation, doesn't mean that there's been any deterioration. It means only that our responsibilities have increased. And you preen yourselves with pride as a result of the increased importance that you have because of your increased responsibilities. But you cry out rather peevishly because of the headaches that the increase of problems will involve. People are that way too. Some people, when they get increased responsibilities, grow. And some people only swell. And nations are that way too. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we didn't have any of the problems of a Marshall Plan and astronomical taxes and providing underpinning for a great many of the nations of the world and what to do with atomic energy and all the other pressing problems which we have to face. We didn't have that in the days just preceding the Spanish-American War. Well, we were a little pipsqueak people then, and it didn't make any difference what we said or what we thought. When you grow to maturity, the responsibilities and the headaches ancillary to those responsibilities must grow too. It happens in your family life. Why shouldn't it happen in your national life? A young couple that just gets married doesn't worry too much about the headaches that lie ahead until the baby comes. And then you're overwhelmed, and you wait only until the youngster could be 6 or 7 years old, and then all problems will be solved. Because when a youngster reaches 6 or 7, you can reason with such a youngster, and then you know that you won't be upset in the irrational way with which an infant responds. And then when the youngster reaches the age of 6 or 7, you begin to wonder how you could ever have worried about an infant. If only you can wait it out until the youngster is 12 or 13. Of course, that's the period when you've got a team. When the youngster works together with parents, there's complete understanding at that time. And then other babies come. And the increase of all of these responsibilities never makes a family say, our family life has now become pathological. There's been something decadent about what's happened to us, because we once had peace of mind, as if that's some tremendous goal. You wonder as you see the bestseller list, Peace of Mind, Peace of Soul, A Guide to Confident Living, and all of the prescriptions that we seek. You wonder whether the American people have actually come to believe that the great goal of life is to have this kind of Shangri-La serenity. You're not going to have it. Not in 1950. When the salesman was lost on the roads of Michigan and asked the farmer for the way to Flint, the farmer said, if you want to get to Flint, you go down this road for about 8 miles and you'll come to a triple fork. Take the extreme... Now, wait a minute. If you want to go to Flint, you go 8 miles, but instead of taking the extreme right, you take the extreme left. Now, wait a minute. If you want to go to Flint, you go... Listen, mister, if you want to go to Flint, you just can't start from here. You want that kind of serenity? That kind of peace of mind? Not in 1950. Not after all that's happened to us. And there has to be an understanding that the presence of problems is not necessarily a sign that there's something pathological in our society. And I ought to add to that, of course, and every good educator knows it, that there has to be an understanding of what we've emerged from as we judge what we now have. We've got too many verbalizers, and it's a fault that's most common, I must confess, among academicians. 1950, there are certain instruments that we've created with a great deal of hope which aren't functioning as well as we hoped they would function in 1945 when the World War ended. That time we created an instrument called the United Nations. We talked about one world. Well, in 1950, it's not functioning as well as we hoped. The world is full of social injustice still. So we've only got the better. We haven't got the best. And the better is involved with a great deal of imperfection. And so we're so perfectionist in our doctrinaire verbalizing that we take the better which we do have, and because it's not the best which we wanted, we associate it with the worst from which we've escaped. The is which we do have is not the ought to be. And therefore, it's just as bad as the was from which we mercifully escaped. In that sense, the quest for the best often becomes the enemy of the quest for the better. Simply because you don't get it all, and all at once, you are ready to write off what you did get. And how many youngsters do you find who are ready to give up America itself because they point to the pus bags that you find in many parts of the country, therefore democracy doesn't work. And they're very ready to give up any international thinking that they may have had and move back to the old Neanderthal isolationism simply because the best which they hoped for didn't come that quickly. We have to have better perspective, and we have to remember at what great cost the precious boons that we do have were purchased. Stephen Vincent Benet puts it this way. There are certain words, our own and others, we're used to. Words we've used, heard, had to recite, forgotten. Liberty, equality, fraternity. To none will we sell, refuse, or deny right or justice. We hold these truths to be self-evident. I'm merely saying, what if these words pass? What if these pass and are gone and are no more, eviscerated, blotted out of the world? They were bought with belief and passion at great cost. They were bought with bitter and anonymous blood, the blood of farmers, teachers, shoemakers, and fools who broke the old rule. The pride of kings. It took a long time to buy these words. It took a long time to buy them, and much pain. And so if your present society is not 98.6, Don't sell it short. Please God, our society's fever chart won't go up to 105 again. Death can be awfully close. There'll always be a little fever in the body politic, maybe 99.2. Not the perfect world that you want. It'll make you less cocky. It'll make you more vigilant. You won't be so sure that you have the monopoly on truth. You remember what you escaped from. I always recall this personal experience in my own family life when my little nephew was stricken with polio. And we stood in that hospital room, and my sister and her husband stood with me as we watched that little boy struggle for breath as the throat constricted, and we heard the beating of the wings of the angel of death. And we wanted only that he should have life, and we would have been willing to settle for anything else if we could only have him. And how far away the ordinary worry seemed to be. What a different standard you have when you're in the valley of the shadow. He recovered. He recovered so completely that there was no impairment at all.